My name is John Okumura. I'm a professor in the Department of Ethnic Studies at UH Manoa, and I do research on race and ethnicity in Hawaii and the continental United States.
Do you specialize in any particular races?
Well, I teach our Japanese in Hawaii course, and well, I used to also teach our Filipinos in Hawaii course and Asian Americans, but I was hired as a specialist in Japanese American studies, so I've written a couple of books on Japanese Americans here and other articles.
Here, talking specifically now about the book Raced to Death, do you want to just say, in quickly explain to us what you mean by the title?
Yeah, okay. The title has two meanings of race involved in it. One, I argue Fukunaga was convicted and sentenced to death very quickly because he was, in the language of that day, of the Japanese race. And for Haoles, he had violated the dominant racial boundary between themselves and non-Haoles, particularly Japanese Americans, who were viewed as the most politically, economically, and culturally threatening group to Haole supremacy. I also have another meaning of race in terms of being rushed to death. This is evident in how quick he was put on trial and convicted and sentenced to die. So two meanings of the notion of race, but certainly the book is more concerned with the significance of race in Hawaii as the dominant organizing principle.
You know what? Would you synopsize the case?
Okay. Miles Fukunaga was a 19-year-old Nisei Japanese-American. Fukunaga targeted his victim, Gil Jameson, after a rent collector from the Hawaiian Trust Company came to their home to collect $20 in overdue rent. So at that point, as he told the police after his arrest, he planned and planned how he would seek revenge against the Hawaiian Trust Company. And that's why he plotted to kidnap Gil Jameson, 10-year-old, from Punahou School, took him to Waikiki in a taxi cab and quickly bludgeoned him to death in the area next to the Alawai Canal. But he was arrested 4 days later, and after spending $5 from the ransom money he collected from Fred Jameson, the father, and willingly confessed to his crime, because as one of his motives was to die, and he had failed in two suicide attempts earlier in the year. And he also mentioned that he wanted to use the ransom money to send his parents back to Japan. He alluded to this desire for vengeance against the Hawaiian Trust Company. And so he was quickly arraigned, indicted, put on trial, 2 days for two-day trial, and sentenced to death on October 8th. But there was a two-week period before he was executed, and this allowed the Japanese American community, led by Fred Makino, to hire an attorney, file appeals that ultimately went to the Supreme Court, which delayed his execution until November 19th, 1929.
What was the Supreme Court finding? That he was not insane?
No, the Supreme Court declined to review the case, but at his first trial in Hawaii, there were three psychiatrists who had examined him, and they maintained that he was legally sane because he could tell the difference between right and wrong. But this is one of the racial injustices in the case, that the psychiatrists, the prosecuting attorneys, Fukunaga's defense attorneys, the judges in the case, never mentioned another criterion for being considered legally insane in Hawaii at that time. And that is being compelled by a force that one could not resist. And so a UH professor who did a very lengthy study of Fukunaga, which came out a month after he had been sentenced to death, maintained that he was legally insane because he was compelled by this desire for revenge against the Hawaiian Trust Company because of the rent collector coming to them and threatening them with eviction. So that's one of the major racial injustices, not addressing this issue of how one could also be considered legally insane according to the Hawaii Insanity Act of 1925.
I know what you're saying, yeah. And then, of course, the Japanese figured, well, he must be insane, because if he was sane, he would never have killed the guy, kind of thing.
The issue of his sanity came up very quickly in the newspapers as a result of the ransom note he sent to Frederick Jameson that alluded to some religious kinds of messages. And so the paper said, well, this ransom letter was written by a someone with a garbled mind or a religious lunatic. And that was quickly dropped after his arrest, because that would have provided a means for him to escape the death penalty. And members in the Japanese community mentioned at times that they thought he was at least mentally insane.
You know, I really would like to go into that more, but I think we better move on to some of the larger, you know, the discussion here. You tried to position this particular event, this Fukunaga case, sort of in a larger trajectory of racial relations in Hawaii. Would you describe that?
Yeah, my argument is that Fukunaga was not just killed as an individual for the crime he committed at that time in September 1928. This is the period of the height of the anti-Japanese movement, the 1920s. Because of their leadership in the 1920 plantation strike that started in January, and under the anti-Japanese movement, they were perceived as politically threatening because of the large population, the largest in Hawaii since 1900.
About 40%?
Yeah, overwhelming. The Hale population was very small, maybe 7%. And Japanese Americans like Fukunaga would eventually become U.S. citizens. And most Japanese Americans in Hawaii were U.S. citizens by 1924. And so the Hales could easily see that once they became of age, they would control the vote. In terms of economically threatening, well, they had organized large strikes against the planters, first in 1909 and again in 1920. Culturally threatening because they maintain Japanese culture in Hawaii, the Japanese language schools, which there was an effort to restrict their operations, if not shut them down, just before the Fukunaga case. So this trajectory, I go back to the 1920 strike. The leaders of the Federation of Japanese Labor that organized the strike, 13 months after the strike was over, were arrested on conspiracy charges, put on trial, convicted, sentenced to 4 to 10 years in prison. And the reason is because to remove them from any kind of further labor organizing activity against the planters. And none of them engaged in any labor organizing after they got out of prison. Many of them just immediately returned to Japan. Subsequently, in 1924 strike, we have Pablo Monlapet and Cecilio Basson, two leaders of the Filipino Labor Union at that time, who would also be arrested. In both cases, perjured testimony clearly was given against them. In the case of Basson and Monlapet, those who testified against them received $100, free tickets back to the Philippines. They left immediately after the trial, and one of them, Panteleon Inayuda, the main accuser against Monlapet and Basson, later signed an affidavit said that they had all lied in their testimony in return for the $110 and a free return trip to the Philippines. So the Fukunaga case takes place very shortly after the trial of Monlapet and Basson. And by that time, Hales knew they could manipulate the criminal justice system to get the outcome that they desired, which was Fukunaga's conviction and execution. The trajectory also extends into the early 30s.
Could you clear your throat?
Oh, sorry. The trajectory also extends into the early 30s with the conviction of the four killers of Joka Hawaii, who then had their 10-year sentences at hard labor commuted to 1 hour in the custody of the sheriff.
Can't help me understand how this played out kind of on the streets. You know, what were the newspapers saying at the time, and how were everyday people acting?
Well, the two dominant newspapers, of course, were the Advertiser and Star Bulletin, who represented the voice of the Haole community, the Republicans, the planters in Hawaii. So they were all certainly for the conviction of Fukunaga and referred to him after his capture as the slayer of Gil Jameson, who had confessed to his murder. And one of the Japanese newspapers, the Nippu Jiji, also advocated Fukunaga's execution. The publisher was Yasutaro Soga, who, with Reverend Okumura, led this accommodationist position of the Japanese community vis-a-vis Haole. So their approach was, let's cooperate with the Haoles and then they'll treat us better, which was a fantasy because Soga was one of those immediately detained following the bombing of Pearl Harbor. The only Japanese newspaper that spoke out on behalf of Fukunaga was the Hawaii Hochi, led by Fred Makino. And so they consistently asked for a new trial and a full psychiatric examination of Fukunaga, led a fundraising drive that to which Japanese Americans contributed $7,000 that was used to hire these attorneys, beginning with Robert Murakami, who Makino approached to appeal the conviction of Fukunaga. And there are these large rallies organized by the Japanese American community on behalf of Fukunaga in Honolulu.
Who went to those, though?
Everyday Japanese people, I imagine, living in Honolulu. The Japanese community, following Fukunaga's conviction, I argue, understood that his conviction was not just against him, but it was against the Japanese American community. They fully understood there was this anti-Japanese campaign against them. And that's why so many of them came to his support, contributed money, attended the rallies, signed petitions. There was a petition distributed by Japanese mothers, signed by 1,000 persons prior to his execution. And following the execution, 4 days later, again, the Hawaii Hochi organized a mass rally at the Chuogaku Language Institute. The building is still there at the intersection of Nuuanu and Vineyard Streets. 7,000 people attended this. This is not the Hawaii Hochi estimating. This is the Star Bulletin. Why was it held outside in a Sunday evening? My belief is they couldn't find a building that could accommodate that large of an audience. And they knew that thousands of Japanese would turn up. I interpret this gathering as a protest against the conviction and execution of Fukunaga. That's why so many people wanted to show up.
Do you maintain that Japanese and Japanese Americans were particularly targeted by the Haole here?
Oh, during the anti-Japanese campaign, surely.
And that's because of what, the large population?
The organization of strikes. They wouldn't remain on the plantation. They were coming to Honolulu. The white working class saw them as threats to their jobs. The Japanese started other kinds of businesses in Honolulu, small grocery stores. They became merchants, very successful, all this during the war. They maintained their culture through the language schools, the Buddhist temples. And they could see the coming political threat through the vote as Nisei became of age, 21 years old. They could easily outvote Haoles, who represent a small population.
There was no way of disenfranchising them, though, right?
Not at that time, no. Mm-hmm. But see what happened actually in the 30s. Japanese, once they became of age and candidates started running for office, they ran as Republicans, the party in power. Because the Democratic Party was so disorganized and lacked leadership that it had far fewer representatives in the legislature, much like the Republican Party at present, so that even those who have these Republican conservative leanings will run as a Democrat because the chances of being elected are much greater.
I found it so interesting that the transition you described, how Hawaiians entered the Republican Party.
Yeah, yeah.
And also that side note, I think, I mean, just you mentioned that one particular fear regarding Japanese Americans was that they were not possibly biologically inferior.
Yeah. The notion of racism during this period, and certainly well after the war, is based on biology, that people are considered biologically inferior in terms of intelligence, personality, morality, other social attributes. And this was certainly the notion of racism applied to Filipinos and Native Hawaiians. But in the case of Japanese Americans, because they had demonstrated this ability to organize large strikes, thousands of workers, not just on Oahu, but coordinating with Japanese plantation workers on the neighbor islands in branches of the overall union, how they feared that they had this organizational capacity to overthrow them politically. And that's why they understood that they were not biologically inferior and could threaten them in different ways, politically and economically.
You know, talk about the what colorblindness is supposed to be.
Okay.
Contrast it with multiculturalism.
Okay. These are two concepts I introduced in the book. One I call incipient colorblindness. The other, emergent multiculturalism. The argument about colorblindness is that, colorblindness now is the dominant racial ideology in America. You know, that most Americans believe that race should not have any formal significance in, for example, employment, promotions, admissions to college, and that what matters is the individual, his personal responsibility for success, his merit and qualifications. These are the criteria that should be used for hiring. And in the Fukunaga case, we have, as I said, incipient colorblindness in the sense that there were arguments that he was not convicted because he was Japanese. He was put on trial and given a fair trial like any haole would have received, which is nonsense. He was racialized as Japanese during his trial based on the testimony of the three psychiatrists, or two of them anyway, who sought to explain his behavior because he was Japanese, such as his lack of emotion. And they related that to a very common stereotype of Japanese at that time as being stoic. Instead, the psychiatrist, except for one who was from Hawaii, maintained what they did not do was evaluate Fukunaga in terms of his individual personality, and particularly one that was depressed, that was lonely, and based on others who, this Dr. Thompson, a psychiatrist with the Navy, his paranoid personality. None of that was introduced at the trial. They mean that he was perfectly mentally sane because he could tell the difference between right and wrong.
So wait a minute. So the contention was that why did he do it?
Well, that's the question raised by one of Fukunaga's defense attorneys. Why did he do this? He asked the jury. You have to address that question, because prior to the crime, he had never been in trouble before, never gave any trouble to his parents, his supervisors at work, and many of them were interviewed by the newspapers, including his parents. And they talked about his very timid, meek, quiet, responsible personality, and that they could not believe he had committed such a violent crime. And The explanation would be, well, there was something mentally wrong with him that drove him to commit such a brutal murder, which he had never had done anything like this before. And this is why the argument of his being mentally insane was being advanced in the community. And the psychiatric exam was only 90 minutes. This is another example of the racial injustice, as opposed to 10 days required by Hawaii law, which was the practice at that time. So the injustice is the judge accepting this 90-minute psychiatric exam. And so one of the demands after Fukunaga was convicted, besides a new trial, was a full psychiatric examination. Can I go back to multiculturalism? So another argument I make in the book is that we see what I call emergent multiculturalism being asserted by particularly the Honolulu Star Bulletin, the Nipujiji. The idea at that time in the 1920s, Hawaii was already being represented as a racial melting pot and a racial paradise. You know, which is nonsense for the 1920s. There's rampant racism, discrimination present. Now, just last summer, there was an article that appeared in the New York Times, for which I and others were interviewed, Want to Be Less Racist? Move to Hawaii. So this is how the notion of multiculturalism is still advanced more than almost 100 years since the 1920s.
Wait a minute. What is multiculturalism? Okay.
Multiculturalism is the notion that we should appreciate the diversity of different groups, cultural, ethnic groups in our society. I mean, it's a simplistic idea that Abercrombie mentioned so many times. Diversity doesn't divide us, right?
So it's appreciating differences.
Yeah, appreciating differences, cultural differences.
Alongside each other in the same society.
Yeah, yeah.
Why wouldn't that work?
Well, no, let me say. So what happened by the 1990s, the view of Hawaii as a racial paradise had transformed Hawaii as a multicultural model for other societies. And this is what you see replicated in that Hawaii a New York Times article. And what I'm arguing is these ideas originate during the Fukunaga case, because the Star Bulletin, the Nipujiji, said by requesting a new trial for Fukunaga and claiming he was the victim of racism and discrimination, the Japanese-American community was disrupting the racial harmony that was prevalent in Hawaii at that time, which is, again, nonsense. Why does multiculturalism doesn't work? You mentioned that. Well, it flattens the differences among groups. It makes it appear that all groups have equal status and contribute equally to society and its culture.
They're not true.
And problems, well, take local culture as an example. That's a popular idea also, that all the groups in Hawaii have contributed to local culture. Well, tell me what the Filipino contribution is, or the Samoan contribution. There are groups that are considered local, but if you look at if any other members of groups besides those actually practice aspects of those cultures, it may be very difficult. That's not the reason groups are considered local in Hawaii. One is the history, a working class history in Hawaii, and being non-white, as the origins of local identity go back to the 1930s. It's not whether or not a group has contributed to local culture. It's their historical working class background in Hawaii. So newcomers are not considered locals. They're like Vietnamese immigrants or more recently Micronesians, even though they're working class, non-white, but they don't have the historical experience in Hawaii. And again, Haoles are not considered local because historically they certainly were not part of the working class.
You're amazing me with this analysis, because I've been feeling it and just wondering what it was about. So you're saying that millennials, for example, people still recognize these sort of social So millennials, people born so long after the first immigrants, still recognize this sort of social hierarchy or stratification that is based on plantation worker history?
Well, it would be more that members of those groups, like, you know, fourth or fifth generation Japanese Americans, Chinese Americans, who are certainly no longer working, come from working class families. Certainly, even upper middle class Chinese Americans, Japanese Americans can be considered local, even if they don't speak Pidgin anymore, even if they went to Puna or went to a very prestigious university on the continent. They would still be accorded this local identity in ways that working class non-whites who are more newcomers to Hawaii would not be considered local, even though they speak Pidgin again also.
It's just, you've really found a really interesting wrinkle here.
Well, you know, the boundaries for many people, based on my experience teaching a course on ethnic identity, teaching another course on race and ethnicity, are such that even locals born and raised, Haoles rather, born and raised in Hawaii are not considered local. It persists as a racial boundary because of the way in which Haoles historically were not part of the working class. They dominated Hawaii politically and economically. As for myself, I don't believe that because I grew up with people who I consider local Haoles. They didn't speak Pidgin. They didn't eat rice. They didn't eat plate lunches, but they loved Hawaii as a local person would. And that's why they're still here.
But what is this affection or what is this local, this working class bonding idea? I mean, it's quite deep-seated.
Well, historically, again, it goes back to the plantation days when finally in 1946, the plantation workers all got together, Japanese, Chinese, Portuguese, the main ones. Japanese, Filipinos, Portuguese, the main ones were still remaining, and joined the ILWU, which led the strikes in that year and subsequent years. And so it was the union that brought these groups together as members of the working class. And
there's some emotional attachment we have to that still.
Well, people understand their history and...
Really?
Well, I based on my teaching Japanese American students, they certainly know about with the Yonsei students, what their great-grandparents did working on the plantations. Local identity has shifted over the years. It's a concept that's based on opposition. Historically, prior to the war, World War II, it was based on an opposition between locals and Haoles, and locals in the military, as evident in the Massacre of Hawaii case. But then the other oppositions emerged subsequently after statehood. Locals versus tourists, as it became the dominant industry. Locals versus foreign investors. And locals versus immigrants following the 65 Immigration Act. So you could have a situation where distinctions are made between local Filipinos and immigrant Filipinos. Mm-hmm. And now I would argue it's local versus the global. The way in which globalization has imperiled local culture and identity. You know, we've become an extension of California. I argue if you look at Ala Moana, you know, as a representation of global consumer culture, the only difference between Ala Moana Center and other major malls you would find in California, other parts of the U.S., it doesn't have a roof. You can find the same shops. And sometimes they're set up exactly the same as they are on the continent. You know, they just bring the same designs.
Floor plan.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And this is why people still assert a local identity, because they understand, they can see that the globalization of Hawaii threatens our notion of what makes Hawaii different, distinct, and what they like about Hawaii. But these, it's the resistance to the globalization isn't organized as it was in the past. In the resistance, for example, Kalama Valley by the pig farmers who faced eviction, or in Waihole Waikani by the farmers again who faced eviction, and at Ota Camp by Filipino residents of that community who also faced eviction. And
why couldn't it form around the people in Kaka'ako who are facing eviction?
Well, there was one to prevent the, it was a housing development, wasn't it? A condo? Yeah. That was a local struggle. It involved numbers of different groups. I think another example of a local struggle is GMO opposition, because that was throughout the islands. It attracted people from different ethnic groups. It was focused on land, as many of these local community struggles are, control over land, which people felt was threatened by outsider forces, particularly investors.
You know, talk about how would you describe the moment we're in terms of race?
Well, the dominant groups now are not just Haoles. You know, I still find students always kind of thinking of Haoles as the only dominant group politically, economically. But since the 1990s, Japanese Americans joined Chinese Americans and Haoles as the socioeconomically dominant groups based on occupation, education, and income. Japanese Americans have comparable status as those two other groups who had emerged earlier as the dominant group socioeconomically. So what I see from the 1970s is this widening gap between Haoles, Japanese Americans, Chinese Americans, and subordinate groups like Filipinos, Native Hawaiians, Samoans, other smaller minorities. And that I don't see collective mobility on the part of those groups in the same sense that, say, Chinese Americans, Japanese Americans had experience following the war and after statehood, being able to rise as groups. There is individual mobility, certainly from Native Hawaiians, Filipino Americans who attend the university or other universities, graduate and get professional jobs, but the numbers are not large enough to say that these groups themselves are also attaining socioeconomic mobility. A major reason for this is our dependence on tourism and the kinds of jobs it creates, low wage, no mobility, service and sales jobs. Very difficult for groups to collectively advance themselves with an economy based on those types of employment. One of the things that I came to an understanding last fall was the opposition to the constitutional amendment, which would provide for a surcharge to property taxes that would fund public education. And this opposition came from four former Democratic Party governors, you know, the party that claimed to be supportive of racial equality, social justice, economic reform in Hawaii. Also came from the University of Hawaii Faculty Union, who, according to the amendment, would have benefited also. The Star Advertiser also had an editorial against the amendment. I think the legislators, led by the Democratic Party, revised the amendment proposed initially by the teachers' union in ways that would lead to its defeat because it was so vague, but it was so badly written, the Supreme Court shut it down. What that made me realize was not just the opposition to address problems in public education, such as its underfunding, because the schools open each year with vacancies for 1,000 teachers. And there's this unwillingness to recognize that as a major problem. So with 70% of the public school students being from minority groups, what I saw the opposition to the passage of the constitutional amendment was also opposition to equal opportunity in Hawaii. The dominant groups are no longer in favor of providing opportunities to the subordinate groups like Filipinos, Hawaiians, Samoans, other minorities through public education that still remains the primary means for their socioeconomic advancement. They have, to me, no concern about this. Certainly you can understand the Chamber of Commerce not wanting to support the constitutional amendment, but members of the Democratic Party, our only newspaper, faculty union, we teach students from those groups. This is how we get our jobs. But that opposition was so strong that, to me, it clearly went beyond whether or not public education is funded, but it was the desire to maintain the ethnic status quo, to keep Haoles, Japanese, Chinese Americans in power and control, keep the Hawaiians, Filipinos, Samoans, Micronesians, other minorities in their subordinate position.
No one would cop to that, John. No one would consciously think that and admit it.
Of course, they wouldn't admit it, especially if you're a Democrat. So they frame it like the affordable.
But do you really think that even in the back of their minds? No.
Well, this is the result.
It's the result, though.
Sure. Where's their compassion for those minority students in the public schools? 70%. It's clearly, the schools are clearly underfunded, which Cayetano wouldn't admit to. I mean, if you have classrooms, schools without 1,000 teachers, there's clearly a problem. And this is despite recruiting teachers from the continent, emergency hire teachers who have bachelor's degrees but no teaching experience or education. They're allowed to teach. And you have this situation. Lahaina Luna High School on Maui was granted a waiver recently by the Department of Education that they could accept teacher applications from persons who hold only a high school degree. That doesn't mean any have been hired, but that's how desperate the DOE is to fill these vacant teaching positions.
Glad you got to that. You know, your book makes a point of talking about how race in that time period determined their socioeconomic status, what kind of jobs they had, where they could live. What role does race play today in those
okay.
kinds of decisions?
Well, this is one of the arguments I make in another book I wrote, From Race to Ethnicity, Regarding Japanese Americans. And it's an argument I make in a subsequent article, that there's been a transformation in Hawaii from race as the dominant organizing principle, you know, certainly during this time. But because it establishes this boundary between Haoles and non-Haoles. You know, certainly people recognize that there are ethnic groups like Japanese Americans or Filipino Americans, but the dominant boundary, you know, that determines one's fate was between Haoles and non-Haoles, and this is evident in the Fukunaga case and the other instances of racial injustice during that period. But my argument is over time there's a transition, and this takes place for a quarter of a century. After the war, through the ILWU, organizing plantation workers, sugar workers, dock workers, and also the Democratic Party subsequently coming to power in 1954 and initiating measures that provide for greater funding for public education and a progressive tax schedule, greater funding for social services. What happened is that Japanese Americans, Chinese Americans, and actually Korean Americans at that time separated themselves from Hawaiians, Filipinos, the other groups with whom they had collaborated in the strikes, in the ILWU, through the Democratic Party. And over this roughly 25-year period, from 46, you know, when the ILWU organizes the big strike mm-hmm. of that year, to, I would say, the early 1970s, ethnicity then becomes the dominant organizing principle to this day. People don't talk about groups in Hawaii as racist. I don't hear anybody do that. People don't talk about the Japanese race, the Hawaiian race, or all the races in Hawaii. The language they use is one of ethnicity. Hawaii consists of different ethnic groups with different cultures. Race is far less significant. And as a social category in terms of its construction, and race is socially constructed, but so is ethnicity. And Hawaii, people talk about our society as consisting of different ethnic groups. And this is a recognition of how ethnicity has become the dominant organizing principle. If you look, for example, at socioeconomic...
Why, though? People don't really see any difference between race and ethnicity.
No, there is a difference. I don't find people using those terms interchangeably. They're far more likely.
I do. People rarely use the word race.
Yeah, they rarely do.
Because I don't think they think it's either you're either white or non-white. So, you know, you don't even need to refer to those categories. In Hawaii, you're just talking about ethnicities within those two large racial distinctions.
Right. Yeah. As I'm saying, in contrast to the continent, people invoke race much more than here. People talk about the white race. African Americans as a race, Asian Americans as a race.
Is that accurate?
As categories that are socially constructed, yes. But in Hawaii, there is no Asian American racial category. We make distinctions along ethnic lines. We distinguish Filipino Americans from Chinese Americans, from Korean Americans, etc. Mm-hmm. We don't talk about Asian Americans. As a racial category.
No, yeah. Neither do we talk about Polish Americans or Ukrainians. You know?
Well, because there aren't...
As they do up there.
Yeah.
So they do.
Yeah,
right?
Because they're more present there.
Mm-hmm. I think I'm understanding that people talk about ethnic groups. Okay, that's like a finer differentiation, right, between cultures.
Uh-huh. It's because of the way that dominant racial boundary prior to the war has been broken down by the socioeconomic advancement of Japanese Americans, Chinese Americans, Korean Americans entering the middle class, and subsequently Japanese Americans, Chinese Americans joining haoles as the dominant groups here politically, economically. How does race explain that? How can a white and two non-white groups all emerge as the dominant groups in Hawaii? How does race explain why Chinese Americans and Japanese Americans are among the dominant groups while Filipinos are not, or Vietnamese Americans? If race is the dominant principle of social organization, we would see clear differences among races here, but that's just not the case. It's among ethnic groups.
Oh, so you think the same dividing lines exist, but between ethnic groups now?
At present, yeah. And that's why I would argue for ethnicity being more significant than race.
But still having the same power over still having the same sort of organizing effect on our culture, society now?
Yeah, because of the inequalities. You know, these aren't racial inequalities anymore. These are ethnic inequalities.
They're economic inequalities.
Oh, yeah. That's one of the basis for measuring inequality.
Uh-huh. Is it a chicken and egg thing? Are you poor because of your ethnic group, or are you that ethnic group who just happens to be poor? Or what? I mean, how do you tease that out?
So if you're a Filipino-American from an immigrant family and you live in Kalihi or Waipahu, certainly, your chances for socioeconomic advancement are less than, say, if you're a Japanese American from an upper middle class family whose parents are professionals who went to private schools here, went to college, graduate school, professional school on the continent. But there are opportunities for that Filipino immigrant and immigrant students from other groups to get an education and attend the University of Hawaii, get a college degree to become a professional and enter the middle class and become a homeowner. Ethnicity isn't as strong a barrier as race was historically. There are these avenues, possibilities for socioeconomic advancement. This is based on my experience teaching at the university for 30 years as I've met Filipino, American, Native Hawaiian students have succeeded. But what I'm saying is the success of those students is limited to these individuals. It's not a group phenomenon. And I attribute that to the underfunding of the public schools that limits the opportunities for minority students who are very much underrepresented at the University of Hawaii. Hawaiians and Filipinos themselves are almost half of the public school students. They certainly are not half of the students at UH Manoa. In fact, they represented roughly half of their proportion in the public schools. So while there are opportunities, they're not necessarily equal opportunities for these minority groups.
You know, what does it say about us that we stop doing those, you know, jokes and whatever other kind of, what, you know, does that say anything about us?
About joking?
Joking, yeah. All the...
Well, joking hasn't stopped necessarily against Micronesians, for example.
I don't hear that. I don't see anybody
in
a comedy circuit making, you know, I mean, we just don't have a comedy circuit like
because
we had
before. Because
you and
I don't have friends who exchange racist jokes with one another. But they certainly go on online. If you should Google Micronesian jokes, you'll find a plethora of them. And my students in my classes say, yeah, when they're growing up, other students would regularly make these jokes, comments about Micronesian students at their school. And what I argue, these jokes are especially vile, dehumanizing. There's no comparison between them and the Filipino jokes that were in vogue before, huh?
In what way?
Well, take the Micronesian jokes. They're compared to cockroaches or racist comments or leeches or feces or garbage. This is what I mean about dehumanizing. They're not considered human beings like the rest of us. And this is an element of racism too, a common element, you know, besides notions of inferiority of another group, how they're not viewed as fully as human beings. So in the Micronesian jokes, they're compared to insects, to human waste. In the case of Filipino jokes, people make fun of the clothes they wear, bright colors, or that they eat dog, but they're still human beings. So this is, to me, evidence of this persisting racism in Hawaii, that even if you move to Hawaii, based on the premise in the New York Times article, that isn't going to make you less racist. Where, you know, the people in Hawaii are the ones who are making the Micronesian jokes. People have lived here for generations. Where did it come from? And the premise is also racism exists in only people's minds. You know, that article is based on a study by a UH psychology professor who sampled students who had moved from the continent, attended university, and then she found that their attitudes about race had declined. Racism is systemic. It's not limited to the attitudes of an individual. It's embedded in the very structures of our society. It cannot be eliminated by coming to Hawaii and attending the university for a few years.
You know, I'm so interested in the ways that it exists around me that I don't even notice.
That's possible. You know, because of the ways that we've become so used to, and because of the notion of Hawaii still yet as a multicultural paradise where everyone gets along so well with each other. Yes, in terms of interpersonal relations, which you can experience regularly, meeting someone from another group ethnic group than your own, and have a very positive experience with that person, because you both live here, you both appreciate Hawaii, and you both have common understandings that allow you to relate to one another. But we ignore the larger setting of Hawaii as a society consisting of different groups that have very different political and economic statuses. We ignore the inequalities that exist in terms of the opportunities. We might be aware of differences in terms of employment, where people live, income and wealth, but we don't necessarily understand why that is the case. We might attribute it to what's called cultural racism instead of biologically based racism. Oh, well, they like to live together with people who are like them. That's why all the Filipinos live in Kalihi or Waipahu. Or they like to be with each other, and that's why they all work in hotel jobs in Waikiki. Or they don't raise their kids with the right values to be hardworking, to desire socioeconomic advancement. Cultural racism has replaced the notions of biologically based racism. It's just a minority of people who really believe that differences among groups are based on biology.
Do you see the sort of the general tenor of the anti-Japanese feeling in Hawaii or and even across the U.S. in the 20s and 30s? Do you see anything like that now?
No, that declined. Huh? In the 80s, there was this very strong it was called the anti-Japanese backlash. Huh? You familiar with that term?
Was that after all the investment here?
It was after, politically, after Ariyoshi had been in office for three terms, the only three-term governor. And by the end of that last term, even Ariyoshi said that he would be the last Japanese American governor for quite a while, and he was he was correct. I mean, not until Ige was elected 2014. So he was aware about the opposition to Japanese Americans in politics because they were the largest group, and still are in the legislature, but at lower percentages than before, and in state government employment by far, and teachers and principals. And that was all part of the anti-Japanese backlash at that time. A lot of hostility against Japanese. But that has declined because of fewer Japanese Americans with the retirement of Nisei in state government and public schools as teachers and principals. Fewer legislators, although they still remain in our congressional delegation. Now, there's always been a Japanese American in our congressional delegation, sometimes three of the four members.
Do you see this kind of, underlying level of racism directed toward other groups in society generally now?
Well, certainly, as I said, the target of most of the racism seems to be Micronesians and the kinds of comments made against them. And I imagine Filipino Americans also, Samoans. It's more the subordinate groups.
Generally, do you think in America today, are we, where are we on this race?
Well, the election of Trump is certainly, given racists more of a willingness to express themselves. In the University of Virginia, Charlottesville, one of the top public institutions that marched there through the city by white supremacists, which the president did not condone.
Did not condemn.
No, Trump has allowed people to express their racial hostility, racist hostility, in ways that was not the case prior to his election. They're just following his lead.
What could this lead to? I mean, maybe it's better now, just getting it out there in the open?
No, I don't necessarily think so, because it doesn't bring people together.
Was it astounding to you, this underlying extent of racism that actually exists in the country?
I guess not, huh? Because racism is so difficult to eliminate. There's this huge contradiction between the election of Obama, the post-racial candidate, and the election of Trump as a blatant racist. And that's hard to understand, how quickly that occurred. And we see, in the run-up to the 2020 presidential elections, this conflict between those kinds of forces, those who still support this racist policies of Trump directed against immigrants and people of color in general, and the Democratic Party, which still advances notions of providing for equal opportunity for all races and tries to bring people from different races together. You don't see that in Trump's campaign. He's not trying to capture the Latino vote, certainly not the African-American vote. He's relying on his base of the white, non-college-educated working class.
Thank you so much. I think we've got it.
Okay.